Following the normal faculty procedure, it is my pleasure to introduce President John A. Hanna for his annual report of the state of Michigan State University, Dr. Hanna.
Provost Neville, members of the Board of Trustees, distinguished faculty awardees, members of the faculty, ladies and gentlemen. As has already been indicated, the faculty bylaws require an annual faculty convocation on the Monday evening nearest February 12 with a statement by the president on the state of the university. As a result of several years of hard work by a group of far-seeing pioneers of this state, the Michigan legislature, 113 years ago today, passed an act authorizing the establishment of this university. And this action was destined to have a profound effect upon higher education in America. It should be a matter for continuing regret that we, the inheritors of a truly significant tradition, take so little outward pride in this heritage. Aside from this convocation, Founders Day receives scant attention on this campus. And yet the action taken here 113 years ago played a key role in opening the doors of higher education to the sons and daughters of the working people of America. And this nation owes much of its prosperity and preeminence to the work begun here on this campus so long ago. Today, few of our students knew or cared that this was Founders Day. Few of the members of our faculty gave more than a passing thought to the distinctive role played by this university in the great social enterprise to which many of us have dedicated our lives. A lament for this indifference is more than sentimentality. A great university must have, among other things, a sense of continuity, a sense of purpose, a sense of mission, and above all, a constant basic philosophy to which all can subscribe. Else it can be little more than a large, complex, impersonal educational machine. Worse, it may well become to deserve the criticism of those who honestly question whether a large public university really can educate its students by the very reason of its size and complexity. Too many believe that concern for the individual lessens with growth in enrollment. Too many protest that quality cannot be consonant with quantity. We're fortunate that those concerned with the governance of Michigan State University, the trustees, the faculty and staff, long ago anticipated the losses we might sustain as the university grew in size, and long ago adopted measures specifically designed to enhance the quality of our educational programs while capitalizing upon the potential of greater size and greater strength. And we can be gratified that any fair-minded critic would agree that measured by any standard, Michigan State is a far better university than it was 20 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, or than it was last year. And the progress made in recent years deserves to be ranked as a major achievement in the history of our university, and there are many to share the credit. As this university enters upon its 114th year of service, it has not lost sight of its primary obligation to extend educational opportunity to all who are qualified without discrimination, to pursue the truth wherever the pursuit may lead, and to put knowledge to work for the benefit of mankind. And those of us who have served the university during the busy decades since World War II will readily recall that it has not been easy. It has been far more difficult than those who have joined us more recently can readily appreciate. And we can understand why progress and improvement have been uneven, why a degree of imbalance still obtains, why there remains much to be done, so much to call forth our continuing effort, our determination, and our courage. And perhaps because of our common experience, we can face the future with more confidence, if not with more equanimity. We can assert without apology our almost mystic belief that Michigan State was destined from the beginning to become a great university in time. If dedicated human beings can build a truly great and distinguished university, a truly great and distinguished university can and will be built here. That is my faith and creed, and I know it is your own. Amid the stress and mounting demands of the past 20 years, and there has not been a year or even a month, and not too many days without uncommon strain, it was to be expected that the university could not answer in advance all of the problems that size and complexity have brought. For example, we could well have given attention much earlier than we did to the careful reexamination of the role of the student within the modern university. But even so, Michigan State was among the first to undertake such reexamination, come to conclusions, and publish its findings and recommendations. And our Academic Freedom for Students report anticipated, in many respects, the principles recently enunciated in the Joint Statement on the Rights and Freedoms of Students, developed jointly by the American Association of University Professors, the Association of American Colleges, the National Student Association, the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators, and the National Association of Women's Deans and Counselors. And we should be highly gratified that our reexamination here could take place in a relatively calm atmosphere where the scholarly approach appropriate to a university could be taken. And we should be grateful to the members of the faculty who undertook this onerous task and produced a report that could be accepted without acrimonious debate and implemented without inviting recrimination. And we should be grateful to the students who participated in the long discussions and contributed much to formulation of its recommendations and are working diligently to make the recommendations effective, as they could not be without student cooperation. And we should be grateful to our trustees who accepted the far-reaching recommendations of faculty and students without quibbling, and are as anxious as any one of us to see this effort and to share responsibility with students meet with unqualified success. And we should be grateful to Professor Dickerson, who inherited the demanding task of making the report effective, along with his new responsibility as Vice President for Student Affairs, and is trying faithfully to help students to exercise both their rights and their responsibilities in a manner befitting students privileged to study at this university. A highlight of the last year has been the searching examination of the undergraduate education programs of our university. And we were fortunate to have faculty members who were willing to undertake this assignment of such tremendous importance to this university. And here again, we were fortunate to have the enthusiastic cooperation of students who properly viewed this project as being of primary importance to them. And the report and the recommendations of the Special Committee on Undergraduate Education are now in the hands of the faculties of the colleges and the principal committees of the university. And what will be done with them remains to be seen. I am confident that the changes will come without undue delay, and that those changes will contribute substantially to the advancement of the university to new levels of quality and achievement. And as you know, Dr. John Wilson has been persuaded to leave his challenging assignment as director of the Honors College to assume the role of catalyst in this area, to stimulate discussion of and action on the numerous recommendations in the Q report. And I strongly urge that all of us extend our full cooperation to him, not for his sake, but for the sake of the university and its future. We have a strong undergraduate program now, better than most comparable universities. It has weaknesses, as the Q report makes unmistakably clear. It is to the credit of our university that it had the confidence to undertake the study and the courage to publish its findings. And it will be to the lasting credit of our faculty if it now proceeds to act on these recommendations with comparable confidence and courage, as I am sure it will. And it would be difficult to overemphasize the importance of undergraduate education on this campus. All of us are properly concerned with providing high quality graduate programs, with encouraging meaningful research, with extending the resources of the university to those beyond the campus. Fellow educators judge quality on all of these levels of activity, but the general public appropriately puts a high priority on the quality of the undergraduate programs. And another example of that high quality was the announcement last Friday that for the third time in 7 years, Michigan State was the winner of the annual National Putnam Mathematics Competition. As you know, more than 1,800 undergraduates were in competition from more than 200 of the best regarded colleges and universities in this country and Canada. And it would be hard to challenge the quality of a department, a college, or a university that consistently attracts and produces this caliber of student. And I should like, on behalf of all of you, to congratulate Professor Herzog and the members of his team for their great accomplishment. Statistical evidence of the magnitude of our undergraduate programs came to hand recently in a report of the U.S. Office of Education entitled Earned Degrees Conferred in the Academic Year 64-65. In 64-65, Michigan State conferred 4,657 bachelor's degrees, and by far the most of any university in America. The University of California at Berkeley was second with 3,959, 698 fewer than Michigan State University. And the University of Minnesota was third with 3,932, and Pennsylvania State University fourth with 3,923. The almost 500,000 degree graduates in the country that year represented 48% of the number of first-time freshmen enrolled 4 years earlier in the fall of 1961. At Michigan State, we started 4,917 first-time freshmen in 1961, and we granted 4,657 bachelor degrees 4 years later. 4,917 first-time freshmen, 4,657 bachelor's degrees 4 years later, a ratio of almost 95%. Of course, not 95% of our freshmen earned degrees in 4 years. We gained from the in-transfer of students from other institutions for their sophomore, junior, and senior years here. But our performance measured in this way has been consistently high. And it is significant that in the same year of 1964-65, we awarded 368 doctoral degrees, and that placed us in eighth place among the graduate schools of this country. Columbia was first with 616, followed by California at Berkeley, Wisconsin, Illinois, Harvard, Ohio State, Stanford, and Michigan State, and just behind for that year were Minnesota and Michigan. But more about graduate education later. Now, another significant study made by a faculty committee in the course of the year resulted in a report entitled The International Focus at Michigan State University. And this, too, represented a diligent and perceptive effort to align the policies and procedures of the university with the demands of today and tomorrow. And this, too, should strengthen the university when it has been thoroughly discussed and the necessary decisions made and the actions taken. The definition of the role of faculty members in the governance of universities is a lively topic on all campuses all over America. After months of discussion and deliberations, a proposed revision of our faculty organization by the Academic Council was recently rejected by a narrow margin by the Senate. And because the matter is still under discussion, it would be inappropriate for me to comment extensively. But I do want to remind you that when the present organization was established a few years ago, many of us were persuaded of the value of requiring deans and other administrators to sit regularly in the Academic Council with elected members of the faculty to discuss matters of mutual interest and concern. And my own experience convinces me that it is good for the president and the provost and the deans to be required to sit and listen to the opinions of the teaching and research faculty regularly. In the process, I have learned much, and I regard it as a valuable experience and in the best interest of the university. The difficulties in communication in a large university are a matter of continuing concern, and I feel that we should hesitate before we discard a useful mechanism for bringing administrative and non-administrative members of the faculty together regularly to discuss and debate topics of importance to the university. The losses might well outweigh the gains. And let me turn briefly to the more general question of the university and the faculty. I heartily subscribe to the proposal that we should find the best possible way to capitalize on the potential of the faculty to contribute to the improvement of the university in every respect. And no one can seriously question that the voice of the faculty is plainly audible at Michigan State University, or that the influence of the faculty on matters of central importance is profound. And that is as it should be and as it must be. And I make the following comments because I think it's important that university faculties here and elsewhere face up to certain realities if they want to foster, encourage, and assure the maintenance on our campuses of the climate required if there is to be assurance that careers as university faculty members are to be permanently rewarding through the decades ahead. And some of these suggestions border on being obligations to their profession as university faculty members. For one, faculty members can and do set examples for the young scholars under their guidance by the manner in which they approach controversial questions, both those relating to university affairs and those relating to society as a whole. For another, faculty members can be subtly effective in the priorities they set for matters to which they devote their principal effort. And we should all have continuing awareness of how our actions are being viewed by others. And for a third, faculty members can be usefully influential in the judgments they pass on the professional effectiveness of their colleagues in day-to-day work in classroom and laboratory, and in the professional restraints that they alone can impose where restraint is plainly desirable. In a university, the definition of discipline must encompass more than a field of intellectual interest and effort. We must be wary of leading our fellow citizens to wonder whether we confuse academic freedom with personal license. Now, earlier when discussing the Q report and our present emphasis on the improvement of undergraduate education, I suggested that we turn later to a discussion of graduate education. There have been suggestions that we instigate a study in depth of graduate education, and these suggestions have general support. The question of timing arises, however, for two or three reasons. It seems to me that such a study should be deferred until the faculty completes or is well along with its consideration of the recommendations in the Q report, its decision on those recommendations, and its action to put them into effect in the original or modified form. And it seems to me that we would be poorly advised to examine the area of graduate education until we are generally agreed on what we intend to do about undergraduate education. And I hope we can reach some general agreement before the end of this academic year, and that the study of graduate education can then be undertaken early next year. Another reason for delay is the direct result of the uncertainty about selective service regulations on the part of prospective graduate students and those who must plan for and teach graduate courses in the immediate future. At the moment, our volume of applications for fall admission to graduate school is substantially below what we would normally expect at this time of the year. And until the federal government makes explicit its attitude toward graduate study for next year and the years to come, it will continue to be difficult to plan very far ahead. As another factor, the retrenchment in federal investments in graduate education is likely to have substantial effect upon universities, including this one. For example, the number of NDEA fellowships awarded to Michigan State has been reduced from 70 to 40. We currently have 12 NASA fellowships. Next year, we do not expect to have any. Now, these cuts go deeper here than at many comparable universities because we've not been able to match the financial support for graduate students that is available at many comparable universities. And one of our real problems is the need to convince the people of Michigan and the governor and the members of the legislature that it costs about as much to produce a PhD at MSU as it does at Michigan or Wisconsin or Illinois or Minnesota or at any other distinguished university. The legislature and the people of this state expect our graduates to be able to compete successfully with the graduates of the most prestigious universities, and they do. And those controlling state appropriations have not yet faced up to the fact that graduate education is expensive education. And the rapid growth in our graduate enrollment has not yet been recognized when state monies are being allocated among our Michigan universities. And it is unfortunate to have these outside conditions afflict our graduate school just now. The growth and development of the graduate program in recent years is symbolic of the increased stature and recognition of the university as a whole. It is now among the major universities of America in its enrollment of graduate students and in the number of its doctoral candidates and doctoral degrees. And as noted earlier, it stood eighth among American universities in 64-65 when 368 doctoral degrees were awarded. This year, at the end of the summer and fall quarters, we've conferred 248 degrees, and those to be awarded in March and June will bring the total to well over 400. We are now graduating in one term almost as many doctoral candidates as we graduated in an academic year 10 years ago, and 5 to 6 times as many in one quarter as we did in an entire year 20 years ago. Now, our unsolved problems serve to remind us again of the inescapable fact of life that no university, least of all a public university, is a wholly free agent in managing its own affairs and planning for its future. Unavoidably, we are affected by influences beyond our campus and beyond our control. Just now, for example, we're awaiting a decision of the legislature on the level of support to be granted to Michigan State University in the coming fiscal year. And it's often hard to puzzle out the prospect, so perhaps you'd like a brief analysis of the situation as I see it. When all the deductions are made from the gross increase in appropriations recommended by the governor in his proposed budget, we have in prospect slightly more than $4 million in new money. And of this total, $3,366,000 is earmarked for salary and wage increases, and another $364,000 to cover probable increases in the cost of things we buy. And this leaves precious little, if anything, to meet the many other imperative demands on our resources. For example, no funds are recommended for new faculty positions, although the budget is built on the assumption that enrollment will increase by 900 new students next year. And this is not realistic. We cannot understand or agree to a system that appropriates to one university in this state $500 more per student per year than is appropriated for Michigan State, or that allocates another university $175 more per year per student per year than we are allotted. And these decisions made by the state government affect the university and its welfare profoundly. And I am bothered by hearing over and over and over again statements that have been made so often over the years that they are accepted as true, to the effect that this university has consistently been favored by the legislature and those in the state capitol. And that simply is not true. We have been favored by the citizens of Michigan, who have consistently sent more of their sons and daughters here as students than to any other institution. But their political leaders have not been so generous with appropriations when numbers of students enrolled, or numbers of credit hours taught, or numbers of degrees granted, the only meaningful measure of university productivity, are considered. And all of this means that this university still has an unfulfilled assignment to convince the legislature and the state's political leaders of the validity of our requests for the funds required to permit this university to serve the people of this state with the programs of the quality and the diversity that they repeatedly indicate that they want from us. Now we're seeing another influence at work on the university, and this time with more welcome results. And this is the growth and development of the other colleges and universities enjoying public support, which results in the lessening of the pressures upon Michigan State to accept large increases in freshman enrollment year after year, no matter what our resources and facilities. And we're cautiously beginning to hope that we have finally reached the state where we can exert intelligent control over our growth rate as measured in terms of students. The freshman class accepted in 1965, the current junior class, may prove to have been the largest class of freshmen in Michigan State University history. Transfers from junior and degree-granting colleges and admissions to the graduate programs may and probably will account for the bulk of enrollment increases in the years ahead. Now, events may prove us unjustified in our optimism, but at any rate, we have no plans to build additional dormitories for undergraduates, although we do have completed plans for an additional residence hall for graduate students, and we will proceed with it when financial conditions are more favorable for building and for borrowing funds. Then there are at least two other influences at work upon the structure of higher education as a whole, including Michigan State University. And both deserve extended discussions, but there's not time for that on this occasion. So I shall only mention them and commend them to your continuing attention. And one is the growing importance of federal funds in educational planning, and the manner in which those funds are granted or withheld, the way in which grants are administered, the fields of educational activity selected for support. All these are matters of major importance to all colleges and universities. And yet, as yet, there is no agreement as to either national purpose or national policy. For example, some funds are granted in support of national security, some in the war against poverty, some in the war on disease, some ostensibly to advance scientific knowledge, some to students, some to institutions. And surely there is need for all such kinds of support and others. But lacking dependable coordination, universities must operate on a basis so tentative as to be both irksome and highly inefficient. And then another new influence with which we must contend is the growing interest of the courts in matters traditionally reserved for decision by academic institutions themselves. And it's too early to foresee the extent to which the courts will intervene, but not too early to be concerned about the possible erosion of the autonomy that many of us consider essential to the accomplishment of the mission with which colleges and universities have been entrusted in our social system. We've long guarded against intrusion into areas of institutional responsibility by the executive and legislative branches of the government at the federal and state levels. And it appears now that we must be alert to possibility of intrusion by the judicial branch as well. Ladies and gentlemen, it would be pleasant if we could anticipate that once our self-studies have been completed and enrollment increases brought under full control, we shall be able to turn away from introspection and relax our efforts to improve the status of the university vis-a-vis the universities with which we like to be compared. But I would be false to my responsibility to this faculty if I dangled any such bright expectation before it. In cold fact, when we've completed our studies and made the changes in structure and procedure that will come as a consequence, we will at best have only prepared this university to face up squarely to the fundamental question facing this and all universities today. And this question or these questions can be formulated in many ways, and I would not claim to be aware of all that should be asked. But they might be covered with one simple inquiry. What is the role of a university in these times? And I shall not labor the point that we live in a time of social ferment when values long held by universities and concepts long taught by universities are being challenged, criticized, derided, reviled. Indeed, the very rationale of our political and social system is under serious attack. And we would be naive, indeed, to expect that our educational establishment, upon which the viability of our system of life depends to a great degree, would escape unscathed, or that our universities would stand apart from the swirling controversy. Indeed, we're already hearing criticisms aplenty, much of it from those who are enjoying the benefits of the very system they say they despise. And such criticism, if not answered quickly and effectively, can bring criticism from a new and potentially more damaging source, the people who support our universities. And we must not blame the hard-pressed taxpayer if hearing so much criticism of the university from those presumably being educated in them, he begins to wonder whether his money is well and wisely invested there. And we must not be surprised if he moves from that question to the more crucial one of whether all of the tremendous expenditures on education are justified if they produce people so poorly educated they cannot work together through the established political process toward the consensus upon which both stability and progress depend. And we in the universities must ask ourselves, and there is no one else to answer for us, whether the kind of education we offer to those who come to us to be taught is the kind of education that will best serve the needs of the individual and of society. Is the structure within which we operate the one best suited for its purpose? Are we in this time of stress too reluctant to give up the forms and trappings of education, too little concerned with the quality of what we impart? Are we aspiring, as some have alleged, to serve only an intellectual elite, ignoring the needs of those who cannot hope for a place at our table? Are we encouraging the American people to set too high a value on what President Tappan once long ago termed, and this is a quote, the bauble of an academical diploma, unquote? Do we attach too much significance to credentials and too little to individual ability? And these are some of the questions we should be asking ourselves personally and institutionally, for they are questions to which answers will someday be demanded. And perhaps the answers to such questions would come more easily if we were to answer unequivocally one other. How much loyalty does a university owe to the social structure of which it is a part? And to answer that one would require us to make, and help students to make, some sharp distinctions as between protest and sabotage, between dissent and revolution. The great American tradition of free speech, refined to academic freedom at the university, is that dissent, protest, criticism must be expressed within the broad but definite limits of the social structure itself. And that is to say, we are free to try to bring about the changes we would like, but only according to the rules by which we have agreed to live. We have accomplished a myriad of improvements on that basis, even changes in the rules themselves occasionally. And the one time we failed as a people to operate on that general understanding, we visited upon ourselves the horrors of a civil war. And the great dissenters in our history, such as Mr. Justice Holmes, have consistently sought to bring about reformation, not revolution. They have not challenged the fundamental assumptions. They accepted the necessity for order and orderly processes of change if our nation was to survive. They did not challenge authority, only authority unjustly exercised. They did not challenge the concept of mutual responsibility for the mutual welfare, but sought to reinforce it. They did not deny the value of representative government, but sought only to make it truly representative. But how different it is with the radical dissenters of our day. They would arrogate to themselves alone the right of dissent. They would confine the exercise of the freedom of speech to those who agree with them. And some boldly proclaim that they will not be content until the whole system is wrecked and brought down, and only then, they say, can a social system acceptable to them be built. And they contend that we have no choice between the lawless and reckless exercise of private license and a straitjacket of absolute conformity with no leeway for the exercise of responsible judgment. And that simply is not true. A Canadian author says better than I could what I would like to say in these few words, and this is a quote. We have freedom to move within an orbit as wide as, but no wider than, what is compatible with the preservation of the overall harmony of the relationships upon which effective living and survival depend. That's the end of the quote. And faced by the necessity to declare allegiance, each of us is free personally to choose his own loyalty. But for a university, this university, there is no choice. It must reassert its dedication to the principles and concepts on which our country has been built with so much pain and effort. It must be proud to be reviled as a part of the establishment, if by that it is meant that the university is an integral part of a social system that, with all its remaining flaws, has given more opportunity and more freedom and more hope to more people than any other system yet devised. And once we agree where we stand, actually the decision was made for those at a public university long ago. But if we agree where we stand, then the answers to the other questions may come more easily because we see our duty more clearly. And we may find it less difficult to assign priorities, to distinguish the important from the inconsequential, to identify the work of substance on which we should concentrate. And as we bring this statement to a close, I would not leave you with a mood of pessimism. We have much to look forward with anticipation at Michigan State University because we have so much on which we can look back with satisfaction in our recent accomplishments. And in this respect, we have scant company among the universities of America. We know our strengths and how to exploit them. We have identified our weaknesses and believe we know how to correct them. And in the modern phrase, we have too many things going for us not to be of good cheer. And not the least of these things is the fundamental attitude of the university and those who serve her, that only people are truly important, and their welfare must come first in our consideration. And someone has said that a university in this day must have a social conscience. And we might answer that this university has had a social conscience for 113 years because its declared purpose from the first day has not been limited to serving our students only, but to serve the people. And that is its purpose to this day, be those people shopkeepers or mechanics or farmers or the wretched residents of the city ghettos. And if we remain true to our traditional purpose, we shall succeed in all we seek to do, because those same people will not allow us to fail. And ladies and gentlemen, that is the state of our university as I see it on this, its 113th anniversary day.